Thanks for tuning in to the Lean 911 podcast, where you'll have a voice directly from the Gemba. I will rely on my three decades of Lean successes, as well as my failures, to answer your most challenging questions regarding your Lean transformation. I'm your host, Mark DeLuzio, President and CEO of Lean Horizons Consulting, and the principal architect of the Danaher Business System. Looking forward to your questions. Now, let's go to the Gemba. Welcome to episode 37 of the Lean 911 podcast. I'm Mark DeLuzio, President and CEO of Lean Horizons Consulting. And once again, I have Kevin Mathis, Managing Director for Lean Horizons. Kevin, you talked about mixed model production part one in the last episode, episode 36. And on episode 37, this is part two. And we said we wanted to talk about mixed model production in terms of how to go about implementing mixed model and all the things that we need to do. Now, just a little summary here, and I'm going to ask Kevin maybe summarize briefly what we talked about in episode 36, but we are going to talk more specifically about implementation. Kevin and I go way back to the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s. And that's 1990, by the way, not 1890. Yeah. We worked together at Danaher, and Kevin was the guy who figured out how to do the first lean, first mixed model production line at one of our divisions called Hennessy, that made wheel balancers and tire changers and all kinds of cool stuff that had to be, you know, machined and assembled and all that good stuff. So, Kevin, why don't you go back and just a brief overview of what we talked about, what is a mixed model, why do we do it, and all that, and then we can get more specifically run into the fundamentals of how do you go about doing this.
Sure. The mixed model one we're going to talk about today is around tire changers, right? So the big machine that has an arm, it comes down and breaks the bead on your tire and it takes the tire off the rim without damaging your rim, and then does the same thing in reverse to put it back on, with which there is several different models. When we think about mixed model, what we're thinking about there is making, say, three of model A, four of model B, two of model C, five of model D, you know, in conjunction with our customer demand. So we're taking the customer demand and breaking that down into daily buckets and mixing that rate down the line in a repeatable mix that more closely matches the customer demand. The opposite of that, the way, more traditional way of thinking would be, well, I'm going to run model A for 2 or 3 days, and I'm going to run model B for a day, then model C for half a day, then model D for a week, or, you know, people would do those in much bigger batches. And the advantage of the mixed model was really driving around reducing inventory, being more flexible to meet customer demand. We improved, you know, efficiency in the operation by improving the throughput of process time through the organization. And then, you know, the responsiveness to the customer is a big deal, right? There, that if orders shifted or there was a mix shift or another issue, we could make it instantly. So it was a good view for how to take care of customers better, how to take care of our people better, and then how to take care of, you know, the capital better by flowing inventory faster.
So Kevin, you know, I think the notion here is we want to mirror the demand pattern of our customers as closely as possible to our production schedule.
Correct. And here we actually took our, and I think that when we get to implementation and customer demands, a big thing to think about how we thought about that.
Right.
But we were able to look at customer demand, build shipping loads so we could optimize freight and delivery to the customer, and then use that to help us sequence the production line so that we could limit the amount of warehouse space and time we had to have in a warehouse to cube out trucks and do those things. So we could really transition to a build-to-order model and sequence it to the real customer demand. on the delivery
So
schedule.
when you say real customer demand, and I did an episode on this earlier about on-time delivery, Kevin, and you know, I talked about so many companies today measure themselves to customer promise date, but at Danaher, we put an edict in that we had to measure the customer request date. So even though you're trying to optimize your shipping schedules and your freight and all that good stuff, you're still focused on the customer requirement in terms of their requested delivery date. Is that correct?
Correct. That's a driving force
Mm-hmm.
under. We should probably do another podcast about, sales and operating process, and how you think about your production schedule and the Heijunka process and how you plan your load and coordinate with customer demand and production. But here we were the real foundation was what did the customer want and when, and that helped us push back then to when did we have to ship it to meet that date, which pushed back to when did we need to make it to make that date. So we're able to synchronize that flow to the date that the customer asked for the product. And we did make that, we had made that switch already to the edict of knowing when your customer really wants it and getting it to them then versus when you promise. And we were transitioning from a stock, using stock to do that and piles of inventory of finished goods to building to that demand and hitting that delivery on a sequential basis.
So the shorter you can make your lead time, including things like quick changeovers and what have you, the less reliance you'll need on a finished goods store to ship that demand.
Correct, correct.
You know, when I look at the one of the episodes I did earlier was just talked about the Toyota Production System. And if you look at the Toyota Production System, there's really five things on that TPS house that Tayashi Ono created. You know, one of the pillars is called just in time. The other pillar is called Jidoka, which is, you know, the process where the machine detects a defect and doesn't continue to promulgate, you know, quality defects. But on the bottom of the house, we have three things: standard work, Heijunka level scheduling, and Kaizen. Now, notice he didn't put there SMED, 5S, TPM. Those are the only three things he put there. And we actually did an episode with Jaime Oba to talk about the basics and what the importance of standard work. So you mentioned Heijunka earlier, Heijunka level scheduling, which is key to this. And of course, I think you're going to talk about standard work and also Kaizen, which you talked about engagement of employees and all that. But one of the things I get all the time, and I'm sure you do too, is people come back to me and say, well, first of all, we can't do mixed model. We can't do standard work because our cycle times are all different. You know, we have so much variety. Another excuse I get is, you know, customers call us at the last minute at 12 o'clock at night and they want it 8 in the morning. And they try to display that that is always the norm. Okay, which it's not, you know that. But if it is, that fundamentally means their SIOP process is broken. The sales, production, inventory, you know, operations planning process is broken, which you're right. That's a subject for another day. Okay. And people like to, you know, project that they live in a world of mystery, in a world of uncertainty, and that their job is so tough and you don't get it and you don't understand. But when you look at your different models that you had, I'm sure the operator cycle times were all, they all varied to some degree. How did you guys handle that?
So I think the first thing was, as we thought about that was, well, what's the takt time? What's the rate with which we need to have the line run? What's the beat? How often does one need to come off a finished good need to come off the line? So we start with takt time, right? And then you think about, well, now what's the standard work for each step of that process? And what if you know takt time and you know the sum of all the cycle times, you can figure out how many people you need, and then you can balance that. And that's probably a topic for another day too. But what we were able to do was to pull the variation off. So say the tag time was 30 seconds. And I'm just making something up. We can't load any single workstation more than 30 seconds, right? And everything needs to be at 30 seconds or less. So we start looking at that work and say, well, what causes variation within the models, right? So some models have two controllers, some have one controller, maybe some have three buttons and some only have one button. And what are the issues that cause the variation? And then work through how do we deal with that. And many of those things we were able to take and move them to some sub-assembly processes on the outside of the line where the water strider or a person floating across those stations could take care of. In some cases, we're able to move and rebalance their work a little bit, but it was mostly just working through how to keep it at 30 seconds and then pulling the variation back out of that line and dealing with that through a sub-assembly process, or maybe the water strider will put two screws in and then put the part up or do something like that so that we're confident that the main pace of the line could always run at tag time.
So, you try to remove all that variation to outside feeder lines, and then, so that would mean then that the operators themselves on the main assembly line would fundamentally have the same work content no matter what the model is, right?
Correct.
I'm sure there wasn't always 100% clean, but in general, you try to get that to be as close as possible. So, and again, this is just a little bit of, basic standard work 101. But in Kevin's example, if the cycle, if the tack time was 30 seconds, which basically means the demand divided into the available time, means that you have to get a part off that line every 30 seconds. No one operator can have more than 30 seconds worth of manual work. So let's just say that the total manual time it took to assemble one complete unit was 300 seconds. Making the math easy. And we
That's
divide that
probably
by
different.
tack time of 30 seconds. That means we need 10 people in that line. And each person working in a one-piece flow environment can't have more than 30 seconds worth of work content. Otherwise, if any one of those people, let's say, had 35 seconds, the drop-off rate on that line would be 35 seconds, and you wouldn't meet your demand. So that's
Correct.
just basic, standard work 101, very basic thinking here, but wanted to get people familiar with that in case you weren't familiar with basics of standard work. I mean, it's a lot more detailed than that, but you got to take in account the equipment and stuff like that. But that's a subject for another day. So I like that idea that you actually took the product and removed as best you could the variation from the line. So now, whatever came down that line, is that how you would do it? For example, you would say, my demand schedule says I need, three A's, two B's, and one C. And then coming down that line again, three A's, two B's, one
Correct.
C. You wouldn't make all
Correct.
your A's first, and then your B's, and then your C's. Is that
Correct.
correct?
That's correct. Right. Yeah. So we would build it in that sequence, and then on the offline, variation that we pushed out, in some cases there might be some standard work in process of one or two parts there
Sure,
that
sure.
the water starter might have assembled to put there. In some cases, there wouldn't have to be. It just depended on the sequence and, as volume shifted in the right balance of standard work for that person. But pulling that off allowed us to build that standard rate to tack time in a very repeatable way.
I've also seen situations where once you understand your production schedule of, three A's, two B's, and one C so many times during the shift, that the subcomponents for that next day's production was done in some sense of a Kanban, so that it was just a pull, and all the operators did during the day was replenish that Kanban, the outside operators. Now, what does that mean? Well, you got an hour day's worth of inventory that you could potentially have some quality problems. So that's ideally you'd like to sync it as close as you can to feed with minimal amount of work in process inventory from those assembly, you know, those offshoots assembly cells, sub-assembly cells, to the main line. So it's interesting. So again, Kevin, you and I seen companies where they would say, hey, no, look, on Monday and Tuesday, we're going to make all A's. Then on Wednesday and half of Thursday, we're going to make B's. And then the rest of the week, we're going to make C's. Mm-hmm. Well, if you got a production order that's due on Thursday, and the or let's say on Wednesday, and the customer ordered A, B, and C, you're going to be late.
Right. Exactly.
Simple as that. Right. I mean, you know, that's the whole idea of matching the production schedule as closely to the demand requirements is something I think that sometimes gets missed because mm-hmm. we're looking at trying to optimize changeovers, or I should say minimize changeovers.
Right.
So let's try to batch all our product families, if you will, part numbers, so that we don't have to do changeovers.
Right.
Well, that doesn't make a lot of sense. Right?
This particular product line had a fabrication area where, you know, we had to do some forming and some welding and you know, grinding and all the things you do to put together. And we took that mixed model concept back as far as we could until we got to the blank, right? Because, you know, in our view was, you know, flow to attack time is what we wanted to get to. And we wanted to minimize the places where we couldn't flow, right? So we just kept working our way back. And, you know, maybe we had a pull situation for a while till we could figure it out. But we kept working our situation back till we could reduce the changeover or build the standard work or improve the processes enough that we could then flow to tack time, right?
You know, I've seen that a lot, Kevin, too, where you try to do a mixed model on the main assembly line, but the feeding operations like fabrication, press brakes, stuff like that, are not working in that fashion. They're working in a batch fashion. So you end up shorting out the line of critical parts, right?
Yeah.
So the message here, I think, is what you're saying is you have to kind of drive that mixed model mentality all the way through upstream and downstream, right?
Correct. Yep. Yeah. You have to understand it from, you know, we were more or less started at the customer, kept working our way back until we could, you know, get as much as possible to flow to tack time, right? And a one piece flow model and just, you know, kept working our way back. So at first there was a press that we got to figure out how to change over. Well, pretty soon you get to where, well, it's not 20 minutes anymore, it's 10 minutes, and it's not 10 minutes, it's 5. And using the Kaizen tools, we're able to keep reducing that time so we can keep it flowing.
You know, it's interesting because if you go back to Jaime Oba's episode that we talked about with basics, his view is that standard work and keeping operators working to standard work, everything should support that notion. So you don't do SMED without thinking about how is this going to keep the line running with standard work. Right. You don't do 5S, you don't do TPM, any of that stuff on a priority basis is all about keeping the operator successful on standard work. And it's not the operator, it's the process, really. I mean, you know, we have to have processes that perform to standard work. So everything that we do should be in context of that standard work, right? And a lot of people look at all of these things as just separate entities, you know, and they're not. I mean, they're all connected, you know. Now, speaking of being connected, how did you guys think about your supply base? Because I see so many companies that don't get to a high junk level schedule, but put Kanbans into their supply base. Mm-hmm. Order in batch. Okay.
Yeah.
And that, they actually create capacity problems at the supplier because they add them, make all A's when they should have made A's and B's. Right. Yeah. So
that was one of our learnings really early on is that as we thought about that process and we had a real reason to make this happen and that we need to take care of customers better. We're growing, we're running out of space. We had to make things flow faster. So there's a real business need. But as we started implementing, one of the first things we did was run out of parts, right? Because we didn't have the process linked to our customers or our suppliers, excuse me, to make them arrive on time, right? So we start working our way back, and then, oh, well, here's a problem. So then how do we solve the problem, right? And we implemented one, a better forecasting model with our supplier so they could see what was coming, and we found out we weren't talking to them very well. And secondly, we implemented a pull system so that they could see that when we use three of something in a day, they got a signal that said, we use three, deliver three more. And we set those up in ways that we could get those parts closer to the sequence that we needed, and therefore, flow the product to that new mix, right? But it was certainly it's certainly a thing you have to think about is as you're implementing all the different parts that you touch, and you don't really know all those till you get going, right? And you're monitoring your production, and you're looking for, why are you not able to achieve your takt time? And then you're problem solving those on a priority basis. And, running out of parts from some suppliers was one of the first things we ran into. And we quickly found out that we were able to work through the 5-why process is what we use, very simple. And go through and say, well, why do we run out of parts? And why didn't they show up? And why didn't they know we needed them? And you start working through that process and mapping it out, and you can start to solve those problems. But we were also sending, by not communicating with our suppliers previous to that, we were sending them really bad information and untimely information, and forcing them to carry extra inventory and respond to us and pay an extra freight cost because we were masking the problem with batch processing. And as we took that batch processing down to the mixed model production, then we could start to see those problems, which allowed us to fix them, which made us much more responsive.
It's funny how the whole notion of the reason people default to batch is to become more efficient, which is so, it's an oxymoron, isn't it? I mean, it's.
It is. You know what we do is we know from experience that that's not true. But you also have to have a problem-solving mindset to know that as you uncover those problems and you lower the inventory and you uncover those problems, then those are opportunities for you to go make your operation better, and you can improve safety, quality, delivery, and costs by attacking those problems and opportunities that you find by lowering the inventory and flowing things through faster.
It's funny because this stuff doesn't work when you have absorption accounting
No.
or OEE measures where there's less incentive to change over, less incentive to do even preventive maintenance, and it's just like we're going to keep the operations running, so just make a bunch of stuff, right? And it doesn't matter what we make because the accountants will be happy because their absorption variances will be favorable. Meanwhile, we're losing business, right? And tell me about this, Kevin. So we talked about the bottom of the house of well, we talked about just in time. Okay, we talked about the fact that try to meet the customer demand when they want it, in the quantity they want it, at the time that they want it. You talked about standardized work, standard work. You also talked about hierarchical level scheduling. And the other thing that's on the bottom of that house is Kaizen. Tell me about the people. Did it benefit the people? How did they take to it? What were the benefits or the cons, right, to this? How did it affect your workforce and all that? Give me your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think that's a it was an interesting transition, right? Because we're coming from not really knowing about how this is going to work to changing the way we think about the line, thinking about production, thinking about the flow, thinking about what the standard work might be, and people are first kind of taken aback and not really sure what's going to happen. What we chose to do was to do use the Kaizen process and work through this process and involve the team on the Kaizen teams, right? So we would have Kaizens every week going on, and people, rotating through working on the teams and helping us figure it out, right? And soon they began to see the benefits of this and see how they could implement things that they knew would improve their production process, but they hadn't been able to implement yet. And that is, like a flywheel, right? It gets going and goes faster and faster and faster. And the engagement, the satisfaction with getting work done, the can-do attitude, the what I would say extra effort of being willing to put in that little bit of extra or come in 15 minutes early to work on your fixture to make it a little better, that kind of thing really accelerates. And that's a fascinating thing to watch and that we were a part of is, and it's really the first time that I'd really gotten to see that all the way through. But it's a huge benefit. Morale goes up, engagement goes up, their enjoy people's enjoyment and work and working together and the ability to think about problems and think about how can I fix this, not waiting for someone else to fix it for them. It really makes a big adjustment. And that's one of the huge benefits that we see in the Kaizen process everywhere is that engagement with having employees and team members all involved does drive engagement. It does drive morale. It does drive teamwork. It drives a complete change in the way you think about business. It's more fun, right? They get to solve their own problems. They get to work on stuff. And they're engaged. They get to use their minds and not just their bodies and doing the labor of
Sure.
a slave or whatever. It's a big thing.
Let me ask you this question. Were you, I can't remember. Were you guys union?
We were.
Okay, how'd you get around that with job classifications and all that? Now, because you may be saying, okay, tack time today is 30 seconds, so Mr. Operator, Mrs. Operator, you're gonna have to do job, step number 17 through 27. And once your tack time changes, you have to reassign the work. And I'm sure you did job rotation as well. So, how do we get around that with the contract and with the job classifications?
Yeah. So we had one, we were blessed, we had a team that worked really well with us and was engaged in what we were doing. And the first thing we did was brought in the union leadership and said, this is what we're going to try to do, and this is why. And we got them engaged in helping with the process, right? And so, and the way our classifications were, an assembler was an assembler, so we could move that work around a little bit.
Oh, I see. Okay, got it.
But that wasn't the issue now. To go to do a machinist or a fabrication job or something like that, we had to either, put someone in that classification there, or if we move someone there, they obviously got the whatever the higher pay rate or whatever the right pay rate was. But for the most part, by engaging them in the process and helping them understand the benefits of that, and letting them participate, we really had not really any issues with, with a lot of arguments or troubles getting workers to go to where we need them to go.
Did you have a did you offer a no layoff policy because of lean improvements?
Yeah, we had that was from day one, right? So, and that was one of Danaher's things, but it's a critical element of lean and a lean transformation. And the employees weren't going to help us if we were going to lay them off because they improve productivity, right? Why would they, right? They want to protect each other, and they're all friends. They want to work. But we were growing, and so that wasn't ever an issue to overcome. But it can't be successful if you don't have that policy. And to be honest, if you're going to If you're going to do that, then save your time and just do something different because it's not going to
Not going to
work.
work. See, I know the answer to that question, but I just wanted to be a straight man here. But and so many people have not done that, Kevin. They have not guaranteed that. So I just had the conversation earlier with a client who has this issue, and told them that operators will actually find creative ways to secure their employment, and you'll never know. You'll never
For
know what
sure.
they're doing.
For sure.
That machine starts sounding a little bit funny. I'm not going to mention it to anybody, right?
Yeah, no, for
You know,
sure.
when you're driving your car and your car starts sounding funny, you drive it every day. You know something's wrong with it when you hear something different, right? You take it into the shop, right? Well, I'm not going to say I'm not. I mean, my machine starts acting up and it starts making funny noises. I'm just not going to say anything. It's going to break down. You're going to miss your shipments. And oh, by the way, I get my overtime,
Right,
right? You
exactly.
can't lay me off, right? And I've seen that happen time and time again. You know, one of the things that we did at Jake Break, so we had a situation maybe a little bit different because we had machining, assembly, we had testing, we had all these things that we put together in a one-piece flow cell. So we went to multi-skill blocks, and then we went to seven skill blocks, one being machining, one being assembly, one being testing, and all that. So when operators learn those skill blocks, they got a kicker in their base pay. When you got all seven, you were known as a multi-skill operator and you got the top pay, right? So people were clamoring to learn all these different jobs, okay? So now it doesn't matter if, and so we got rid of like 70 job classifications. They had 70 of them, okay? And went down to seven skill blocks. The mistake we made was we didn't do a good job recertifying people because if you, let's say you got certified in machining, but you didn't do machining for 6 months, okay? Well, guess what? You didn't get, you lost your skills
You
by
lose the
not doing
skill
it,
set,
right?
yeah, right.
So we didn't do a good job, but the key to that one is just to rotate people quite a bit so that they get those skills are staying fresh, you know? So, but other than that though, that's the thought process. And of course we did have that no layoff policy, right? So, that was key,
In
but,
this case that we're talking about, what we ended up doing was rotate because there's a lot of variations in the stations, and with the mix would change from, essentially we set the mix every week, but we rotated the assemblers through all those workstations. So every day they were in a different station. So they just kept rotating. And so one, that gave us a lot of flexibility if someone was gone or the mix shifted. And two is they enjoyed it more. The work wasn't as monotonous. They got to change what they
It's
did and
variety, yeah.
try different things, and they would have different ideas on how to improve those workstations, and they'd work with their teammates to continually improve those stations. So that rotation and cross training is a big deal. It certainly helps drive, safety, quality, delivery, and cost. It drives all those things. And helps contribute positively to the way the organization works.
Well, what about the idea that operator number two now has done operation number eight, and like I know what that operation needs, and then makes improvements there that says I think when I get to op this part gets to operation eight, if I do this differently, it's going to be a benefit to that operation, and without having that cross fertilization, you're never going to get that, right? You know, and I've seen that happen. You know, one of the things I've seen though that backfired on us in one of our companies. We had a brazing operation in the cell, and it was hot and it was ugly, and nobody wanted to do it. So we were rotating on a daily basis. Okay. So on Monday, you would do the first set of operations, and then you move to two, and then you move to three. Well, when you move to brazing, it seems like every time somebody was assigned brazing, that was the highest absenteeism.
Well,
So
that's
what
a
we did is
problem.
we rotated during the day. 2 hours here, 2 hours there. So everybody got it every day so that people wouldn't be calling out when they were assigned to that particular
That's
operation.
interesting.
That actually backfired on us. But so we fixed that by just doing daily, during the day rotation type thing. So, yeah.
I guess the question would be is how would you make that job so that people want to do it?
Well, it's a real good question because it's a reflection of a bad process. It really is. And that's the key that a lot of people don't understand. You know, when you don't make your productivity numbers, it's not because you got lousy operators or maybe they're not trained and that's your fault. But it's also a reflection of, geez, the process doesn't work. Right. I just had this conversation the other day with somebody who called in on the Lean 911 podcast. Well, called in, they emailed me and they said, hey, we get wide variations of operators doing the same job. Mm-hmm. And we want to bring HR in and talk to the people, and they're focused on the people. Mm-hmm. My answer to them was, it's not a people issue.
Right.
Now, look, if they're not trained, that's one thing, okay? But if they are trained, it's a focus on the process. If you can't repeat the process, and I repeated the notion that said that Toyota, you know, we learned from Toyota that they get brilliant results with ordinary people running brilliant processes. So when you can't make it, and if you're looking at your people first, you got to look at the process first. Look at yourself first, because you as leaders are responsible for assuring good, repeatable processes that are not tasking like that brazen operation, right? If somebody just doesn't want to do the work and it's tiring, and this is why we don't allow fatigue in standard work. We want to see the fatigue. Why? Because we got to create processes that don't fatigue our people. And that's a whole different approach. I go crazy when I hear people say, oh, standard work is just like industrial engineering studies. No, it's not. No, it's not at all. You know, but Kevin, this is great. Any other thoughts?
No, I think that, you know, as you think about the process of building the customer demand, building standardized processes around that, engaging the workforce to help you implement and get engaged in Kaizen, and then trying to flow to tag time everywhere you can, and keep working that process, you'll get there, right? But you know, that would be the real keys to kind of think through of, if I'm going to implement mixed model, how would I go about that? Those are the things I would think about.
You know, I like to use the example, I might have used it last time, but put things in very layman type everyday terms. You know, I've asked people, they say, well, why should we do mixed model? Why should we do more changeovers, right? And I just say, well, did you ever have a barbecue in your backyard, right? And let's say you're making hamburgers and hot dogs for 20 people. Do you only make all the hamburgers first? Well, no. Oh, that means you must make all the hot dogs first. No, we don't do that either. Well, why not? You make them both. You make hamburgers and hot dogs. Why? Because some of your guests want hamburgers, some want hot dogs, and some want both, like me. And that you want them to eat together. Well, when you look at a production order and you got those five or six or eight different brake models that you talked about, okay, or tire changes, I think, right? Okay. Yep. Well, if the customer is ordering all of those and they all want them on one delivery date, how could you make all part A on Monday and Tuesday,
right?
When on Wednesday you got to ship all five, you know.
Right.
So that's the whole concept, to marry that production plan as close as possible to your demand schedule, right? So and it changes, right? I mean, that's more of an S&OP process, where over the course of time, how often did you change the mix of that production schedule?
We changed the mix weekly.
Okay.
And we changed the overall tack time monthly-ish. So sometimes a little more, sometimes less, depending on what was happening with volume. We had, part of the things that we had to build was a very robust sales and operations planning process, so we could see what that demand was going to be. Because you can look backwards a little bit, but you need to be in tune with your customer and understand what your customer needs and when they need it. So you can staff and build your standard work and notify suppliers and all those things you have to do. So, you know, we had to build that foundational process, but weekly we changed the mix, unless something, you know, really, really significantly happened. But we have built enough flexibility that if we needed to shift, we could.
Yeah, and you know, that's another good point, by the way, maybe beyond the scope of what we're talking about here, but first couple points that come to mind is, Standard work is a verb. It's not a noun. It's not something you did. It's something you do to run the business and to make improvements, right? Mm-hmm. So your standard work had to change. Well, first of all, if you change tax time, your tax standard work definitely changes, right?
Changes, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the sequence might change that standard work too, okay?
Yep, it does.
The other thing is getting the commercial team in concert with what you're doing so that when they take an order for 50,000 A's, you ask the customer, well, do you really need 50,000 by June 1st or do you need 10,000 a month for the next 5 months?
Right.
That doesn't happen a lot because a lot of times our compensation programs or sales comp programs are based on our orders, not on our shipments, not on our orders.
Sure.
So you end up with mirror and mirror, you know, unevenness, unreasonableness, with just that policy alone.
Yeah.
And how does that, you know, and that affects your mixed model operations, right? I mean, when you got the sales department just creating, actually incentivizing their customers to violate just-in-time thinking.
Right, right.
I mean, that's what that is.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
That's why everybody has to be on the same page.
Exactly.
Wow.
I think talking about sales operations planning, inventory planning, it's probably another topic for another day, but it was a foundational element. And you talked about high junk overloading being at the bottom foundation of the house. It was a foundational element to being able to do this, right? Because we had to get the whole organization to what's the real customer demand, not what does a sales guy say. And that's a very important factor to think about as you're planning what that production level is going to be.
You know, it's funny when the salespeople say, "Well, you know, you're asking us to predict the future, right?" But then they have these kind of behaviors.
Yeah,
the future is pretty easy to predict if they're doing that, right? I mean, Well, this is great. Okay, so to sum this up, I mean, it mixed model is not easy to do, and you need to get the basics down first. But and you know, you almost have to have the ability to do standard work, for example, as a muscle memory type of thing, where it's not always a big hurdle for you to get that done, and incorporate playbooks and all that for these different type of configurations for your standard work, right?
Right.
But I think if you kind of look at the Toyota Production System house, you kind of check most of the boxes there, and I think that's benefit. And, you know, and again, it was great because it was early in our maturation on the Danaher business system, which you were part of contributing towards putting that together. And you were the first mixed model line in Danaher. I'll bet you there's all kinds of people listening to this are going to say, "No, we were first. No, we were first." No, you weren't. I was the guy that went around every company.
Yeah.
We weren't even doing it at Jake Break. So where it all started. Okay. So that was a real benefit. And you guys did a nice job there in terms of how you all, you know, handle all the whole Kaizen infrastructure and the framework of that. So, right. Kevin, this is great. Thank you. So we got a lot of other things to talk about, but
we'll get those on.
Let's leave this one where it is.
Okay.
And if there's any questions on mixed model, please send them in, you know. And I would just probably leave everybody with this last thought to say, please focus on the commonalities more so than you do your differences, because you'll talk yourself out of it and you'll convince yourself how tough your job is and all that. I remember George Sherman telling a company vice president, "Geez, John, you're doing a great job convincing yourself how tough your job is. Maybe we can find somebody who doesn't think it's that tough, you know?" So
I think you just have to flip the question around to say, "How am I going to do it?" And just start solving one problem at a time.
And, hey, look, if you're going to be successful and grow the business and satisfy your customers, it's a non-option, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Another question is how, exactly.
Exactly.
Kevin, thanks. This was episode 37. I'm sorry, one more thing?
Nope, that's it. No, go ahead.
Okay. Well, this is Mixed Model Production Part 2. Okay, we did the introduction in episode 36. This is episode 37 with Kevin Mathis, Managing Director, Lean Horizons. former Danaher, former HNI and Han. George Conosacre stole you from us. After,
yeah. Yeah.
And I don't blame him anyway.
Yeah, George is a good man. Yeah,
George is a great man. Yeah, we got to try to get him on the podcast. So,
yeah.
But okay, Kevin, thanks. That was helpful. I hope everybody can learn from this. And it's not easy. Yeah, you will struggle, but it's the benefits are more than worth it. So, we'll see you guys all next time.
Yep. Thank you.
Okay. Take care. Thanks for listening to the Lean 911 podcast. I'll be happy to address your questions or feedback on future episodes. Email me at mark@lean911.com. You can check out our other episodes by visiting our website at lean911.com, our YouTube channel, wherever you listen to podcasts. This is your host, Mark DeLuzio. Thanks for listening.